actually, I believe it was big swinging dicks. So there was obviously an overexcited imagination on the part of some, I would suggest.
Because if he wants to know what misogyny looks like in modern Australia, he doesn't need a motion in the House of Representatives. He needs a mirror.
I love the mansplaining. I'm enjoying it.
What's mansplaining, Senator?
Welcome back to In the House and In the Senate, where we talk to the women of Australian politics about who they are, what they do, and why it matters. In the House and In the Senate is supported by Plan International Australia, the charity for girls' equality. As a leading humanitarian organisation working in 80 countries, Plan International Australia tackles poverty and supports communities through crisis. Plan work on some of the most important issues of our time, from gender equality, sexual and reproductive health rights, sexual harassment, and action on the climate crisis. I'm your host, Alicia Aiken-Radburn. I'm a former federal and state political staffer, passionate about making a positive change in our world. Let's get into today's episode. Hannah Smith is the National Campaigns Coordinator at the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union, also known as the AMWU. The AMWU represents tens of thousands of workers across Australia in all areas of manufacturing, from food and confectionery, metal manufacturing and engineering, printing, design, packaging, and more. Hannah has worked in various capacities at the AMWU for the past 6 years, starting as an organiser with print workers. Hannah has worked on a variety of election campaigns over the years and in the electorate office of the Deputy Opposition Leader, Tanya Plibersek. Some of you might even remember her from her role in season 2 of Bachelor in Paradise, where she featured as my best friend. She really is my best friend. I'm very grateful that she can share her insights as a staunch unionist and feminist with us today. Hannah, welcome to In the House and In the Senate. I'll start off with our first question we always start off with. What is a day in the life of the National Campaigns Coordinator at the AMWU like?
Thanks, Leishi. It's a bit of a weird one at the moment, I think, for so many people. I'm real deep into this second lockdown here in Sydney. So where I usually would be out and about, I'm sort of relegated to my tiny dining room. But some things remain the same. So I wake up every morning, check in with our media monitoring and check if there's any issues that our members will need us to speak on or act on during the day. Have a quick team check-in to make sure we're all pulling in the same direction. And then I've had a bunch of meetings today. So everything from job security across all of the Australian workforce, plus safety, particularly around welding. And then
niche.
very niche. I've learned a lot about bromide and other things. Meeting with a colleague about our campaign to support Australian manufacturing, and then catching up with some workplace representatives from food manufacturing, which is always fun because they have the best treats. And then just in between, just doing general bits and pieces for our national secretary, which is kind of like the leader of the union.
Han, it's, you know, you mentioned welding. What is that like? Like, you know, and I know you personally, you're not a welder. tell me about this. I feel like it's not attention, but it's like you have a role in the union movement. You're not, I know there's a term for it, you're not a
rank and filer.
What's that like when you sort of have this maybe knowledge gap between some of the stuff that your workers are doing on the ground and you're having to advocate on their behalf?
Well, I actually think so. You know, there is a principle in the union movement that the people that you're representing, you should look like, right? And so I agree with that. I don't look like a lot of the members that I work with. But I think what I try and do is take that knowledge and understand whatever process it is, whether it's welding, whether it's making lollies at a confectionery factory, et cetera, and find a way for people who we are trying to change their minds, for example, politicians, find a way for them to understand it. So I try and be sort of the conduit between workers on the ground's experience and the very short attention span of lots of our politicians. So that in that way, sort of like a translator. But after doing this for 6 years or so, I am starting to learn some of the sort of practices and the trades, etc.
I don't think a lot of young women, sort of, I'm coming at it from my perspective, women in their late 20s, a lot of people who are not sort of in the Labor Party would really know somebody who works in the union movement. What is it like, what drew you to working in the union movement?
I guess, I think you know some of this story. Obviously, you and I met at university. Through student activism, which is a really, really cool way to spend your early 20s. But there's always, I guess, so that was the path in, right? So activism at a student level, it feeds pretty neatly into activism in the workplace, right? But of course, there's always more that calls out for us to take that initial step. So for me, feminism was where my commitment to sort of change and sort of organising started. So through high school, I guess I knew that I thought the world could be much better for women, but I sort of didn't know how to articulate it or where to direct my anger and frustration. And then I guess at university, meeting and talking with other young women, we could sort of name what it was that we experienced and then go deeper into why we had all had this same experience and what structures underpinned it and how do we change it. And I guess from there it was an informed decision that I sort of have learned how power works and how power can be shifted, and I made a decision that I really wanted to affect as much change as I possibly could in my short working life, and the union movement was the most effective place for me to do that.
Can I take you back to high school and, just this feeling that the world is unfair for women and sort of like maybe, your early feminism, but not being able to necessarily label some things like the patriarchy. What do you think you were noticing in the world that was sort of galvanizing you and making you, to, for lack of a better word, like feel emotions and want to change things?
I guess there's every single interaction that we have builds the person that we want to become, of course, but there are some that stand out. And so I think for me, and I'm still not very good at telling this story, but for me, there was a woman who looked after me in my last year in high school. I didn't live at home. And she was a survivor of domestic violence, a single mother to three kids. And she took me in, even though she had very meagre resources of her own. I'm forever thankful for that, and I totally credit her with getting me to university. But what I noticed, and I couldn't put my finger on it at the time, was she was a cleaner, and I saw her go to work and come home and work so hard every day and didn't make nearly as many dollars as people that I know worked as hard or less hard than her. And I just couldn't understand why how hard she was working was not reflected in how many resources she had for her family. And I thought, this doesn't seem right to me. And from there, I guess that's sort of like what sticks in my mind and sort of fuels the fire moving forward.
How do you feel that you say fuels the fire. How do you feel that like your passions have translated into your work? What are some of the things that have sort of stood out to you? Like, you've been working at the AMWU for 6 years now. What are the things that you've sort of achieved that you're like, hell yeah, that fulfills me? And it sort of helps me, with that pain of seeing somebody that was working really hard and isn't as well resourced.
I think the thing that the value that all the sort of thing that I've carried with me is how important it is to be vulnerable when you're doing this work and this organizing, because it is real people in their lives. And you have like a lot of amazing tough women that I respect who say you've got to be tough, you've got to water off a duck's back, but that's just never worked for me. I feel it all really deeply, and I think that sort of drives my motivation ongoing. And the thing that really stood out to me, it isn't very sexy, Leash, but I think I always tell this story when I'm talking to young women about getting involved in the union movement. I think at the start of my organizing time, I met a bunch of mostly women, mostly second generation migrant workers at a McDonald's in Blacktown. They were really scared. They were paid just above the minimum wage, really hard to get by, doing really hard work. And together over 6 months or so, we got organized. We got them a union contract. They got themselves a union contract. They fought and won a union contract. And they won a 9% wage increase over 3 years. And that doesn't seem like a lot, but for people who are living paycheck to paycheck, it's the difference between being able to send your kids to, you know, sport on Saturdays or pay your bills without going into debt. And really it's their story. So they took all the risk. But a lot of work in organizing and politics isn't very glamorous, and it doesn't put us in the limelight, but it actually does change people's lives. So as much as I'm sorry it's not really fun and saucy, I think that
I completely agree with you about vulnerability. And I think that, you know, a lot of our world and how we sort of work together, whether that's like corporate or politics or what, or family, if we acted with more vulnerability, I think that we would, you know, I think things would work more effectively. Can you tell me about organizing? Because I feel like, you know, for someone in the union movement, and, you know, I've been adjacent, even I don't probably really understand what organizing means. What does organizing mean to you?
I'll talk about it in the abstract, and then I'll give real examples, right? Yes. So organizing is really about working with people to identify what is wrong in their lives and how we can make that change. And that involves always involves power and shifting power. But you can't sort of make a buck on that. You actually have to do the work. And what that looks like in the Australian context is spending time in different workplaces, talking to workers, understanding what their issues are, and giving them the tools and the confidence to act not alone as themselves, but as a group, and demand change, whatever that is. And, you know, like sometimes it's pay rises, right? But sometimes it's smaller things like being able to wear this kind of uniform, or, you know, it might even be bigger societal change, like, you know, a development that's happening in your neighbourhood, or, you know, marriage equality. That was organised, yeah. Right? In my experience, you know, a lot of workplace organizing, so shifting the power in the workplace so that the boss doesn't have as much and workers have a little bit more, but organizing happens everywhere.
A lot of that would be incumbent on union membership, I imagine.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, this takes me to the fact that, like, it's no secret that in Australia, trade union membership has declined. From 92 to 2020, the proportion of employees who were trade union members have fallen from 40% to 14%. And that has, like, that's a lot of implications for workers' power and working as a collective to get better outcomes from the bosses. why do you think that is? And, like, why do you think union membership has declined? And why do you think unions are still relevant in 2021?
Yeah, that's a really good question, babe. But I think so your statistics are right. And if you even go back further to sort of the 70s, it was well above 50%. And when unionism was that high, we saw gains not just for the workers in unions, but for everyone. So not a lot of people know this, and fair enough, but unions were at the forefront of the fight for things that we enjoy and take for granted today. So things like superannuation, our Medicare system, better working rights like paid parental leave, et cetera. And obviously, I think it comes as no surprise to a lot of us that Conservative governments didn't like how effective trade unions were at socialising the wealth of this country, making it fairer, better, et cetera. So Conservative governments over a long period of time, over decades, have worked slowly to unpick the power of working people and their unions. They've obviously had some hiccups. A lot of us might remember, or some of us might remember as kids, our teachers going out on strike.
Is this your rights at work?
Yeah. Yeah. So they made the Conservatives under John Howard made a really big misstep in their project to sort of disempower unions by trying to throw it all out at once and throw out all of the wins at once. So what they learned really quickly was they had to do it bit by bit by bit so that they hopefully nobody notices. And I think you're right, you know, it is fair enough for young people to say, well, why? Like, why do I have to part with $13 or $8 or whatever it is? But we need to turn it around because really our generation, and I'm, you know, 28.
You're young, we're gonna babe.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
But we're gonna be the first generation that not only won't be winning new rights, but we'll be going backwards in terms of, you know, our parents and our grandparents had more than us. And that's pretty despicable in my mind. And so, you know, unions, a colleague of mine always says they're the biggest and most effective social justice movement in the world. And just a quick story, at the start of the pandemic that sort of, you know, makes unions relevant to our daily lives. At the start of the pandemic, we brought all of our workplace leaders together. And we said, we've got to act collectively here because this is a big challenge. We need to stick together, but we need to win for our members. So what we landed on doing is directing all of our energies and all of our efforts for about a month and a half or 6 weeks into putting pressure on every single boss to provide 2 weeks paid pandemic leave.
Yeah.
We won it in 90 workplaces, which is not enough, but something. And
when you say workplaces, like what sort of workplaces are we talking? Is it like Woolies?
So my union doesn't cover Woolies.
Yeah.
We cover factories,
yeah.
Food factories as well, where a lot of people might know there is a big spread, right, of COVID at the moment, and it's a big problem. So we won that. And not only did that take a weight off members' shoulders in terms of they didn't have to choose between paying the rent and protecting their community and their family, but it was also a social good for everyone in the community because it meant less circulation of the virus. And so that's just a really recent example of something that we won, but that was because workers decided this is a priority for us, protecting our people and protecting our community.
How do you think that the union movement can sort of stay relevant in 2021 and attract more members, or is it just inevitable that collectivism has sort of waned?
I think it has. Like, we know that, right? Like, there's so many studies that say people aren't coming together in institutions anymore, right? They're not going to church in the numbers that they were. They're not going into their unions. They're not members of their local footy clubs.
Yeah.
but I have a little bit of hope because I see particularly, like, you know, my younger siblings or, you know, the next generation after us who are coming through, you can tell that they're angry at the state of the world. And soon enough, they're going to recognize sounds super patronizing. That's probably not what I mean. But soon enough, all of their work that they are doing, which is super noble, super good, you know, going to a protest, sharing something on social media. The truth is you need something more sustained.
Yes.
And something better resourced. And so I think hopefully I have hope that people will start to see we need to come together in a more meaningful, structured way to continue to fight this in our everyday lives rather than one Saturday I'm going to a protest at, you know, Town Hall or Fed Square or something like that.
Because I think that, like, a lot of do I call us millennials? Yeah, I think we are. I think a lot of us who have sort of come through student activism have been really floored by the incredible power and radicalism of these, like, you know, I'm thinking of school strike for climate and I'm like, I felt like a boomer, literally, like standing at the back of this rally. And I'm like, oh, the young kids, they're so good.
I was talking to a girlfriend about this the other day. Like, literally, they put me to shame. Like, they really do. And they are so effective. And, you know, in my work, I've been working because obviously blue collar workers are, you know, going to bear the brunt of the change that's coming with the climate. I've been working with some of those school strikers and I'm just floored at not only are they real advocates for themselves, but they are real advocates for everyone. So, you know, their activism doesn't just talk about the future, their future that the government is ruining, but also First Nations people's futures, blue collar workers, regional workers. And I just am floored at that level of empathy, really.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think it's really amazing.
So, Han, the MO of unions is to, as we've said, sort of fight for fairness, stand up for workers. And as we are well aware, this past year has seen a groundswell of conversation and grassroots action. I'm thinking like March for Women, around the treatment of women in workplaces and wider society. You have previously worked for political parties and in political roles. What are your feelings about this year and this moment in time?
I think that I probably share a lot of your feelings. I know we've spoken about it a lot, that it feels like a reckoning, like the moment sort of here. I know myself and I know so many others are talking to the women in their networks, whether it's at work, whether it's their families or their friends, and we know what the solutions are. I think what I'm most worried about in this is not everyone's commitment to it, but it's how we win. So I think we really need to jealously guard the anger and the resolve to do something about this, because there are a bunch of people in power who benefit from the system as it exists, hoping that we give up. And so we need to make it a movement, not a moment. We can't just go out and protest one day and think that that's going to fix everything. We need to keep the power, hold power to account, keep the pedal to the metal, whatever, because I think there are people who benefit from the way things are that are just hoping that they wait out our anger and continue on as normal. So, yes, I think it is a moment in time. It's a reckoning, all of those things, but we need to carefully and thoughtfully make sure that we continue that work so it's actually lasting change.
So talking about winning, I feel like when it comes to sort of addressing these issues, it sort of seems like we just have endless reports. So in the like parliamentary context, we've seen the Foster report, we've got Jenkins being handed down in November, which, you know, I've mentioned on the podcast before, I was a part of the process and I thought it had a lot of good to it. Outside of parliament, we've seen another Kate Jenkins report, Respect at Work, which I imagine in sort of like your union context, there would have been a lot of conversation about. Do you think these achieve anything? And like when we talk to winning, how do we win? How do we solve this cultural issue? I'm asking you. I've got a bloody unionist on the podcast. I'm like, you have to tell me in half an hour, how do we smash the patriarchy?
Yeah. Well, okay. You knew that I wasn't going to come on this episode and not find an opportunity to gas you up. So I just want to say thank you so much for being brave enough to speak to the review. I think that is just so amazing. And I'm really, really just obsessed with you, of course.
Obsessed with you too.
I guess your question was around these reports, right? And yeah. How do we win? And I think the beauty of progressive movements in this country is that everyone has a role to play. Whatever your skill is, there is something good that you can be doing. And I don't want to what I want to say is the reports have been fantastic in highlighting very clearly what the problem is, where power lies, and what needs to be changed. And I am really grateful and admire the women who have done that work. But the thing is that change doesn't happen when we ask, just because we ask nicely. So, or it doesn't happen because the Prime Minister commissions a report, right? Mm-hmm. It happens through identifying where the power is and organising hard to fix it. And it happens when we run sustained and really strategic campaigns that make it too risky for, in a reputational sense, too risky for the people in power not to act. So really good that these reports are naming the problem, but this is a means to an end, not an end in itself, is how I see it.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. And I think that you touched on something that I feel very deeply, in the sense that I think that every woman has a role to play and has a different, their activism might look different. Mm. Like someone might go to a rally, someone might be working on academic policy. And there are so many angles that we can come to it. So do you think that really the answer is just, as you said, to keep your pedal on the metal? The phrase. Is it just about momentum, and it's just about keeping having these conversations? Because God, man, it's tiring.
It's so tiring, right? And it is really hard not to let it grind you down. And to be honest, like it does some days. Like I think that the thing that potentially a lot of women, particularly women in leadership, are reluctant to talk about because we're worried it will discourage people is that sometimes it just really grates you and really gets you down. I think it's the pedal to the metal stuff. I think the other thing to remember is sometimes we want to,
I was going to say, what does winning look like to you?
Well, I think it's there, right, in the report. And we know, you know, I was listening to someone the other day talk about we've had the answers for so long, right? Like a major one in terms of men's violence against women is social housing.
Yes.
And just no one has built it, right? And so we know what they are. And I think reports also potentially give a false sense of progress because it's the same solutions, right, as 20 years ago. Just no one has had the political will to do anything. So I think winning looks like to me people actually just pulling their finger out and doing it, right? And, you know, we know politicians by their name are political animals and they need to be able to see the electoral risk for them for not acting. And that usually means talking to a bunch of people in the community and making them care about it. But that's just one way, right, to achieve change. There's so many ways. But I think the thing is we're just not coming together enough. Like we need to come together and talk and figure it out. You know, you saw the Women's Safety Summit. You know, like things like that shouldn't be an exclusive event, right? Anyone who cares about this stuff and wants to build a better future should be there.
I agree.
You know, give us a ticket, Scotty.
Han, I might wrap it up with this one question because I could talk to you all day. I always end my guests with asking what if they had one piece of advice or wisdom to young women interested in, you know, getting more involved, interested in unionism, what would your advice be?
I thought a lot about this because you know me, I am just the queen of just like turbocharging any young woman with all of the advice and all of my experiences so that they're armed and equipped with it. And really that's just so silly and unrealistic. And so the one that stuck out of the laundry list of things about how to sort of survive and make it in sort of the political space is find a mentor. And I know that sounds really icky and like school campy.
No,
vibes,
I like it.
But, you know, like the thing is, if you're feeling it or experiencing it, it is 100% certain that there has been a woman before you who has been through it. And you shouldn't have to sort of weather that alone. You should absolutely be able to just get on the phone with someone to say, you're totally right, you're on the right track, keep going, or here's something you should think about. So, you know, it feels uncomfortable, but just ask someone for a cup of coffee and ask them that you'd like to pick their brain, you know, in your field.
I think that's very solid advice. Hannah Smith, thank you so much for joining me on In the House and In the Senate. And I can't wait to give you a cuddle in Sydney. One
thank
day.
Thank you, Lishi. Thanks, babe.
In the House and In the Senate is recorded on the land of the Whadjuk people. This land was never ceded. It always was and always will be Aboriginal land. If you enjoyed this episode of In the House and In the Senate, please jump into your podcast app, subscribe and give me a quick rating and review. This will help the podcast reach more people and I will personally be incredibly grateful. Also, be sure to head over to the podcast Instagram at In the House in the Senate, where I'll be sharing content from our guests, throwbacks to my time in staffing and resources to help you get more involved in the political system. You can also follow my personal account at alicia.aikenradburn. Thanks for listening and speak to you next week.
Bye-bye. Goodbye to Liz. Bye.
Next question.